We left our last conversation about Montauk discussing mind control. And in it, we said that there was really two different ways that mind control program worked. One was the initial one was a physical way, which eventually emerged into an electronic way. Could you sort of describe both of those programs and how it went from physical to electronic?
Yes. First, one has to understand the basic mechanisms behind this. The research which led up to this kind of a program attempt was work that was done originally by Dr. Wilhelm Reich of Austria. He was a student, considered the prime and best student of Sigmund Freud. And, of course, he was over there prior to World War II and prior to World War I. I don't know Sigmund Freud's entire history, but he did have quite a school going, and Wilhelm Reich was one of his principal students, and according to Freud, perhaps his best student. But Freud had some strange ideas. Wilhelm Reich was particularly noted in that he agreed to some extent, but also differed with Reich in terms, Reich differed with Freud in terms of Freud saying that most of the motivation of human life is sexuality. Reich didn't entirely agree, but he had his own ideas. Wilhelm Reich, before he came to the U.S., spent about 2 years in Russia. He thought that the Soviet system might give him more freedom of thought and action in terms of his research. Freud encouraged Reich in his research, even though he didn't agree with it. He says, go ahead and do your research. He said, continue it. So he left the Soviet Union rather in disgust, from what I remember reading, and came to the U.S. And he came to the U.S. in 1943 during the war period, World War II. Lived in Long Island area, Queens, for a while. Then he set up his laboratory after the war was over in Rangeley, Maine, and started his research work up there. He acquired a CIA contract in 1947, the year that the CIA came into existence in a formal sense with a charter, for doing mind research. The CIA said they wanted a contract for him because of his reputation, and they wanted him to find out, is there any ways you can deprogram people and possibly make psychics more psychic, particularly with younger people, to make them more psychic. On the basis of that contract, Reich went ahead and did all of his research for 5 years. It was a five-year contract. And his experimentation involved many things, including some very wild sex orgies and parties, according to what history states and what we've read. But he came up with a very basic idea and a very basic formula, which is used essentially to this day. The programming of a person requires somehow you access their subconscious mind. That's been a fairly well-established fact for quite some time. How do you access it? Well, he found out how. That basically, the subconscious mind is accessible to the conscious mind at the point of orgasm. It took him 5 years of research to find this out, apparently. But the problem is, of course, orgasms don't last very long in terms of the male. How do you extend that orgasm in order to be able to do something? But he found that it's does access the subconscious mind. The conscious and subconscious merge and become one, if you will, so they sort of talk to each other during the point of the orgasm. Now, I don't know how he found this out, but that is what the records show. And I say the records, it's a private contractual record, his notebooks, which went to CIA, NSA, and Preston Nichols got a hold of some of this information, and finally a deal was worked out where he got all of the notes, because the last half of them were fudged by Dr. Reich because he realized what the CIA really wanted and he wasn't about to give it to him. But he finished the contract and then said, I will never work for you again. But eventually, the full records came out and Preston found out what the whole story was, and NSA CIA did also. Basically, his research showed you can program or modify the contents of the subconscious mind through the conscious mind at the point of orgasm, but somehow you have to manage to extend that so that you can put in adequate information or compress the information.
So did Wilhelm Reich actually figure it out, A, how to bring this orgasm about, and then B, how to inject the programming at this state?
I'm not sure if he came up with the answer how to inject the programming, but he certainly found out as part of it that the subconscious mind is accessible and programmable during the period of orgasm. Now, maybe he worked out a technique for extending the normal orgasm, which doesn't last more than a couple of seconds with most people. To my mind, I would say you'd have to extend it to a couple of minutes to be able to do an adequate job of programming. But I'm not quite sure that that's entirely necessary, and I do not know exactly what he accomplished, because those records are classified to this day, and the only person outside of the government who's ever seen them is Preston Nichols, and he's sworn to secrecy on it for the rest of his life, and that he would never show any of those notebooks, because he has a full set of them, to anyone for the rest of his life. That was the agreement he made in order to get the rest of the notes. Based on those notes, he figured out a system which apparently would work. Now, Preston, dropping Reich for the moment because he found out how to make it work in a theory, how do you make it work in fact? Preston apparently found out a system to make it work in fact. He came up with the idea that through a homosexual approach, because it was also learned that the programming techniques only seemed to work for a male. Females did not seem to be accessible for the subconscious using this type of technique. Therefore, the problem became, and of course, in the first work, and for a long period of time, the work that was done with the Montauk boys was boys only. They could not use that kind of a technique on girls. With the changeover to an electronic technique, the later electronic techniques, girls could be approached just as well as a boy. That's why for years, for centuries and millennia, females were only programmed by means of the long drawn out cult techniques.
So there was obviously some state that they went into that was different than just a regular orgasm.
Yes, there was a state they went into that was different than a regular orgasm, and it required a homosexual type act.
And why do you think that was?
Because of the structure of the nervous system in terms of both the male, well, in terms of the male period, both in terms of the male genitalia and also in terms of the nervous system involving the anus. They're very complex structures, they're very complex nervous systems, and there is a large amount of I'm not sure what the correct term is. Sensitive points, particular ganglia of nerves, which are involved, whereby you can transfer energies from one to the other. And it's a transfer of energy that is required when the programmee, the one that is being programmed, is in the proper state. And you have to get into the proper state first, which requires some preconditioning. And in the proper state, the nervous energy would transfer from the programmer to the programmee and would then become what was installed into that individual and would become part of his subconscious.
Oh. Okay, so it would go from the programmer
to the programmee.
The messaging would.
The message, if you will.
How did it initially get into the programmer then?
The programmer had to be programmed as to what the message was. It was to be delivered to this individual because not every Montauk boy programmed Montauk boy, of course, was programmed for the same program with the same message. There was quite a wide variety. They started out in a fairly simple form, but it got more and more complex as time went on. They wanted programmed people for different functions. They'd be programmed for a certain function, or they would be programmed to, let us say, come into the final station or the final operation, and you get your final instructions in phase two at another station after you were turned on to the fact that you've already been partially programmed by the access techniques which were built into this thing.
So if you were, say, going to be programmed as an assassin,
yeah,
then did the programmer have to have already received the full details, and I can imagine it'd be a whole lot of information.
It would be details and information as to what kind of programming you would do, what kind of assassination you would do, but it would not involve, in that phase, would not involve a target, i.e. would not involve the name of a specific person. This would be a case where they would probably be instructed to report in for final instructions. Final instructions would be, you will go out and do so-and-so in, and you will do it in this manner at a certain location.
So it could have been that they were just programming him to be a type of person who, upon command, would execute whatever they say to execute.
Yes. There are several approaches to this.
I have it.
But this is one of the approaches they could use. And the other was, if they were to be programmed for something, let's say, simpler, like be a spy, gather information, that's a little easier to implement. If they are to be, let us say, an arsonist, go out and start fires in some particular location or so on, they would be programmed as an arsonist, that it would perhaps be given the instructions, you will be in such and such location at a certain time advance, or they could be given, again, instructions to go in and get your final programming from another location or another source. It depends exactly what they wanted to set them up for. Of course, it could be a very complex two-part or three-part program, but they would be basically selected for a specific operation, and that would be installed in them in the first place. And once it was installed, of course, and the information was buried in the subconscious, they would be returned to the normal state, so to speak, where the conscious and subconscious are separated, and the only thing that would reconnect it would be a set of what would be typically called post-hypnotic commands, which say, if these words or these numbers or whatever sequence of coding is run past you, then you revert to this program. And then the program, if it tells you to go to a next step, you go to the next step. If it's to do the particular thing at that time, then you do the particular thing at that time.
Now, was the age of the programmee very important?
Yes, it was. They found that the people who were most easily programmable, most susceptible to all of this, were those around puberty, the beginning stages of sexuality. They were the most easily programmed. They found, whether it's by experience or whether it's from Reich, I don't know, that when you start to get, when you get up to the age of about 17, you start to develop a mindset of your own. You start to develop your own personality, which does go over into the subconscious, of course, the levels of conscious and subconscious personality. But at that age, you start to develop your own personality, and therefore this would interfere with programming. Therefore, they wanted to get the programmees at the age around puberty, which could be anywhere from 12 to 16. Some usually, typically between 11 and 15 is more likely.
And many of these boys apparently resisted.
Yes, when it came to that point, because I will have to add certain aspects of this. How did they get the intended victims? How did they get the Montauk boy programmees in the first place?
That's a good question.
Initially, they went out around Long Island and picked them up in a van at night, late, kidnapped them, quite literally, bring them in and say, we want to use you for this program and so forth. But then, of course, you get to the point, I want to go home. Well, you're not going to go home. They could use a number of techniques on them to try to bribe them. In some cases, kids were bribable. In other cases, of course, they refused. They locked them up. Then they would threaten them. And then, of course, if they passed the other requirements, which, of course, they had to have a physical screening, they had to have a psychological screening, they had to have an IQ test. That threw quite a few out. But picking up from families along Long Island, wandering around the streets at night and so forth, quite a number of them would pass the IQ test. There's no problem with that because the basic IQ requirement was 100, which is to say average. But they had to pass a few other requirements, including genetic. Those were fairly easily established. Some of them established as they went around trying to pick the kids up. They could see immediately either they fit the genetic requirements or they didn't, i.e. they were in Caucasians or they weren't. And at that stage, they were interested only in Caucasians, Aryans, if you will. In terms of physical appearance, health, that's fairly obvious before you pick them up. certain things they could have checked them out for, and they wouldn't pick them up if they didn't fit the standards. But then they have a medical test, then they have a psychological profile test, then they had the IQ test. If they passed all of that, assuming that they could get the kids to go along with that much, they make it into sort of a game. Then come to the point, we want to use you for this and this, and there's another aspect of the programming and so forth. Some of them would be resistant right from the beginning. Others would go along with the part way, and others would go away along with this apparently all the way. But those who resisted, if they saw that they were a good candidate, they didn't want to lose the candidates because in the early stages, they were rather hard put to get a candidate. Not like later on, but they were rather hard put to get a candidate early on, so they would try to beat them into submission. And this is where another person came in as part of the, shall we say, conditioning aspect of the candidate to accept the programming. They would quite literally beat them into submission with a baseball bat or some equivalent thereof. They didn't use fisticuffs. It was quite literally just beating them. Now, some of them didn't survive the beatings, and some of them were injured. I've met one or two on the island who still had scars and injuries from the time 10 years prior.
Now, what was the time frame of the physical activities from Montauk? Was that in the early 70s when that happened?
In the terms of when they started this program at
right.
Montauk? About 75, 76. I would say, okay, what I know of it, about 1975.
So I would imagine a lot of these boys were killed, apparently never returned. Wouldn't there have been an uproar along the island of, you know, where's our missing kids?
I'm sure there would have been. And this is when I got into the program, one of the things I said to them, I said, particularly in the later phase when I took it over, but I said this in the beginning, I said, you pick up these kids here from people on the island, and many of them are wealthy, have a lot of connections, and they have clout. I said, you're going to have problems. It's going to be in the press.
Was it ever in the press?
Not to my knowledge. Apparently they were able to control the press to keep it out, number one. Number two, possibly they paid off the families if the families really started to get anywhere in the investigation. But I think in most cases they were able to divert investigations to dead-end it. I'm hypothesizing in that aspect because I don't know how they kept it quiet, very frankly.
I mean, I can imagine there was a large number of boys that didn't come back.
Eventually that was the case. In the earlier phases of the program, most of them did come back. There were relatively few who did not, but there were some who did not. Mm-hmm. And the scope of the program at the beginning was not large numbers. There were small numbers.
Okay.
Because each one was literally handpicked, and each one was put through the program individually. They didn't do numbers at a time. They did one at a time, one on one on one. In other words, one person and one programmer. Eventually, they got to more than one program, so they could do more than one in a 24-hour period. A particular programmer was typically not capable of doing more than one person, programming more than one person in a given 24-hour period, and they didn't expect them to. So they had a more than one programmer with the physical techniques to do this, to get more than one person through it a day. Later on, with electronic techniques, it was a little different. Well, this physical programming technique didn't sit too well with a lot of them, and even when they did accept the programming, quite a few of them wound up dead. The medical aspects of this I cannot fully explain because, I'm not an MD, never was, and B, I only got this information secondhand that the type of physical programming that was being engaged in at times with certain kids will produce an enormous backlash in the nervous system to the extent that it's so enormous it kills them outright. Mm. And this is what happened to some of them. Mm. Nobody could explain medically fully why, but it did happen. So one more dead body to get rid of.
Now weren't some of these Montauk boys also used in the testing of the time tunnels and subsequently disappeared?
Not initially, but that did come in afterwards. They used some of them to do take a trip through time, whatever. Now, a person, I would say, typically speaking, the young kid asks, how would you like to travel in time? If they understood what it was all about, they'd probably think it was a great thrill, a great thing to do. In today's language, it would be very cool. Mm-hmm. They lost a few.
So that's a lot of people. I mean, I can envision hundreds, perhaps.
Probably. There were. There were hundreds. Eventually, there were thousands.
Okay. Thousands. How do you keep that quiet?
They didn't all come from Long Island. See, that was the initial part of it, was they pulled the kids off of Long Island. Then they started pulling them out of New York City, where there's a lot of kids on the streets that had no homes left. Then it transferred to, well, let's go after the homeless kids.
Yeah, but Caucasians, you know, that's a smaller group than other
groups.
It's
a smaller group. Eventually, I know other programs we've been dealing with non-Caucasian. They found out it worked just as well. Mm-hmm. But eventually, they toned down the bit of the pure Caucasian aspect. They pulled in as many of those as they could. But eventually they had to expand their horizon, so to speak, and when the Montauk Tunnel operation was working properly, somebody, I don't know who, made the suggestion, why not pull some of these street kids off from some other part of the country? Because literally you could use the tunnel to go up to that and do a scouting number, pick some potentials, somehow trick them or whatever into getting to the vicinity of the tunnel. They get sucked through the tunnel to Montauk. And they're there. Well, how they treated them from that point on was up to the management. But they were beaten into submission, essentially, if they didn't go along with it until 1979. Now, it still was a case of beating them into submission if they didn't want to go along with the program, even though we changed from the physical aspect to phase one of the electronic system. You could say really it was phase two in a way, but was the new system was electronic, because it was found with a lot of medical experimentation and lab work that you could induce the same state in the individual for programming electronically as you could by a kind of physical sexual act.
Let me ask you if you think this is even a possibility. Could they, in, say, 1978, go back to when Ronald Reagan was a small child, 13, 14, pull him up, do the programming on him, put him back at 13 or 14, and then when he's president of the United States, he is essentially a mind-controlled slave?
Very definitely they could do that if they wanted to.
I mean, they could do it for anybody then.
It raises a good point, because how do we know now, during that period of time, that they did not pull a number of politicians through, knowing who was going to be in line to be in the Congress or the Senate or a president?
Really wouldn't matter.
Go back in time and pick them up as a kid, run them through the process, program them, and there they are, waiting to be used. And when the time comes, they plug in the program. It is a very scary thought, but you also have to look at the fact maybe it has happened. Because if you look today at some of your politicians, it's not just the U.S., but let's say just for the U.S. alone, so many of these politicians start out, I'd say, at a local level, finally get themselves elected to the Congress or the Senate in Washington, many of them thinking they're going to go down there and straighten out this mess and do something for their home folk and for the good people of the U.S. And they get down there, and within 90 days or 6 months, whatever the time period is, they're totally turned around and become nothing but another cog in the machine doing what they're told to do. This is obvious to a lot of people on the outside. When you look at these people, how many of them have turned around and become ultra-liberal or do whatever they're told to do, whatever it may be, whether they're on the the liberal or the conservative side, they still fall into a pattern and they do what they're told to do. Very few remain independent. There are independents, partly because of their own mind power, and partly because to keep up appearances, you've got to have a certain number of independents. This is an idea which you just brought up. It's a very good point. This is a possibility that this could have been and is being done.
Well, we're just hypothesizing at this point.
At this point, it's a strictly hypothesis, yes.
Right, because, Al, I think you mentioned you really only worked at the operations level. You weren't in the administrative level.
I was not in the administrative and political planning level, if you will.
Right. You just saw what was, you saw the assembly line, so to speak.
The assembly line, but not those who were controlling the assembly line.
Right, or had any idea of what actually happened once they were out in the field, so to speak. That's quite interesting. Now, the program went from a physical program to an
electronic
program. How did that transition happen?
Rather gradually. They tried it out to see if it would work as well, and they found out it did. It had a few glitches, too, because they had to tailor the equipment. They were using basically an EEG-type machine, which was modified. It had two floppy disks in it, that I remember. And how they exactly worked, I don't know, except there was a combination of monitoring the person's electrical responses, which, of course, what is an EEG machine does, basically.
Did you play any role in the design of this equipment?
No, I did not.
Do you know who did?
I can only suggest that Preston might have, but I'm not sure of that. Beyond that, I do not know who was involved in it at all. Okay. So you have a double set of pads, so to speak, maybe perhaps twice the normal number, for A, monitoring, and B, for injecting an electrical signal into the human system, such if it is done properly, it will cause a sexual arousal and of course, put you in the state of orgasm. But
Al, where did they place the pads?
They placed them on the head, they placed them on the nipples, they placed them on the shoulders, they placed them on the stomach, and in the case of the male, of course, they placed them on the penis. And they could cause whatever kind of reaction they wanted and induce the proper state. And by properly tailoring these signals, as even the ancients knew from various forms of extending sex through some of the older Far Eastern techniques, it can be done electrically. And it can be done without electrical systems, but it can be done electrically. And consequently, you can extend the orgastic period. With that, you can take what time is necessary to plug in the program. Now, you have a secondary advantage in terms of plugging in the program. It doesn't have to be done verbally. It doesn't have to be done on a slow process. You can do a second floppy disk, which will inject the program electrically, as well as holding the state. So that will go into the nervous system, and it goes through to the subconscious.
So wait a minute. Could you have one floppy disk?
There were two floppies.
Right, but one could have the actual program that they're trying to inject into the person,
yeah,
and the other would be the procedure to run it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Now, in the earlier stages, and I don't know how far down the line this worked, they could plug in a program manually, that is to say, speak into a microphone, and then have it transferred into an electrical signal, and the electrical system being impinged on the nervous system, so that if you were using one of the earlier systems used, I'm trying to remember the guy's name who developed this, an electrical system for replacing the hearing aid. It was a type of system where you spoke into a microphone, was amplified, converted into a series of waveforms, which were connected to the electrical system through pads on the surface of the body, and this would turn up in the head as a signal you heard, an autophone, whatever you wanted to call it. They could use that type of system where it was verbal instruction, which was converted to an electrical signal impinging on the subconscious, or it can be done by a floppy.
Well, I've heard people interviewed where they say that we have the technology to, at a distance, make it sound like someone's talking in your own mind.
That's true. Now, that came a little later. Took a little more research.
Okay. This could have been the start of that development, though.
Yes, it was, because if you look at even the commercial area, the open series of patents that are on the list of some 26 of them are in some way associated with mind manipulation and mind control, which can be from either audible or visible techniques or both. You go back to the old orophone. You go into other systems involving microwaves, and you don't have any physical connection. You can do it by impinging on the brain through microwaves, and a person will hear whatever you're speaking into a microphone, or if it's a recorded program, same difference. Mm-hmm. All of these systems were developed as time went on, and that's all in the commercial literature. It just doesn't say that there's some more refined systems in the classified literature, which you don't see.
Well, I can only imagine that, what's in place today.
Exactly.
Here we are 2,000, many years later. technology has.
Most of these systems were developed in the 70s and the 80s, not even up into the early 90s.
There's no comparison with a computer back in the 70s to a computer today.
That's right. And if you combine a computer with one of these access systems to the human subconscious, you can imagine what we can do today to a person. They can turn them into a working robot if you want, or a person on remote command using his own eyes and ears for observing, and through this a link which could be two-way, use that person as remote eyes and ears and control them from, let's say, some control station at some remote point, and have them do what you want to do as you go, rather than as pre-programmed, and have that person under total control.
Al, this is not a good thing.
Not a good thing, agreed.
Do you think that there's any countermeasure to this? Anything that perhaps another hidden agenda is doing to stop this from happening?
I would say there probably is. In terms of something ongoing in terms of electronics to counter it at that time when such a system is in operation, I don't know of any. There are other systems for deprogramming and trying to straighten out the mess that some people get into, and that would have to be a separate topic.
Okay. All right. But let's go through some history here. Apparently 1981, the Montauk Boys program pulled out?
Yes, it was pulled out of Montauk. Before they pulled it out, however, there was a major change made, and this is why it made it possible to move it to other locations, because it simplified much of the proceedings. I first went to the electronic programming technique, a modified EEG machine, which was successful, but they were still beating them to submission. I looked at this and I said, there has to be a better way. I was involved in other projects too at the time, but I finally went up to Jack Pruitt and said, I came up with an idea. I think there's a much better way you can get a better product and an increased yield, if you will, from the Montauk Boys program if you do this, this, and this. Pruitt listened to me and said, this is beyond my capacity to act on it. He says, this is out of my realm. He said, you have to go up the line to somebody who has the authority. I don't have it. My idea basically was, instead of beating them to submission, get their cooperation by offering them a carrot. The carrot, of course, being most of these kids were street kids who were broke, left home for whatever reason, were trying to live off the streets any way they could. And they picked them up because they wore this, and they were more susceptible to being programmed. But at the same time, turn it around and say, all right, you work with us, and we'll work with you. We will do, if you work with us and go along with our program, and after it's over, you won't remember it having been done, but we will carry through, and what we'll do for you is this. We'll establish a bank account in your name. You will have access to it. There will always be money in the account. It will be somewhat limited as to how much you can draw, but nevertheless, you'll have enough to live on. Go back to school, get an education. Most of these kids have dropped out of grade school or high school. Go back and get an education, finish out high school. If you can get a college degree and want to go on, go right ahead. Until you finish your education at whatever level you decide you want to go to and go into the mainstream of society, which you're expected to do, you will be fed the money in your account. Once you go to work, he said, we will no longer do this. You will be supporting yourself as a standard member of society. If you want to go along with this, we'll do this for you. And, of course, you will be subjected to our programming. You'll never remember it. But at some time in the future, we will probably need you. As a matter of fact, quite a number of these kids were never used. There was a backup which was never used. And when they get past a certain age, they won't use them. That is age being 35. That seems to be the cutoff point. Well, they don't want to use these guys anymore unless they're in a very critical area where age doesn't matter.
Are you saying because the programming doesn't hold past that age?
No, because if it involves something physical, physically strenuous type of activity, running around the streets, doing some other thing requires a lot of physical strength. After 35, people start to slide downhill, and it just became a cutoff point, which they established, rather arbitrarily, but this is what they established. Also, they can become harder to control and manipulate after 35, because the brain starts in its own way to slowly deteriorate. In any case, that's where they cut it off. But many of them were never used, but nevertheless, they're set up as a secret army, and they were there. They might never get called. It's sort of a gamble that the individual would take if they accept the program. But what happened was, of course, 90% plus accepted it, and we told them, if you don't want to go along with it, that's all right. We'll send you back where you came from, but you'll never remember having been here. Mm-hmm. And you'll never hear from us again either. But no beating, no trying to force them into submission. And the person who was guilty of doing the beating the submission into submission was removed from that program and used elsewhere. So the yield went up to something slightly over 90%. Everybody was happy with that. It also then made it possible to expand the program, because it was highly successful at that point. And it was about 81 they did. They expanded it off of Montauk, moved into six locations in Long Island, and then in every major city in the U.S.
Were these six locations underground locations?
They're all, yes, I understand they're all underground.
And all the other locations, everything was underground?
Were they under different? Some cases underground physically, and in some cases just underground in terms of society's knowledge of the program.
So wouldn't they need a time tunnel in conjunction with this boys program at that physical location?
It depends on how they wanted to carry it out. In the case of the programs that were ongoing at Long Island, in which we uncovered one in 1997, it was not on Montauk. It was in, or should say, under a town which is not far from Montauk. The whole facility was physically underground. Now, how they processed the kids there or not, I don't know. Having the physical hardware does not require a lot of space, but how they got them in there and pulled them in, I don't know, because Montauk stopped doing this sort of operation back in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. Now, they may have established another technique for doing it at another location, or perhaps a totally smaller, more portable facility. I have no idea of that as to how they handled that. But the captured records from that one site on Long Island indicated that they had pulled in people from outside of Long Island. In fact, in one case, somebody from Australia. Now, that required the use of a tunnel, a time tunnel. I don't think they pulled them by plane and by car.
So if you were to hypothesize on how many people have been run through this program, what would your guess be?
Well, I can tell you what my guess was originally. When I say originally, when I first remembered my involvement in the Montauk Project and the fact that I was involved in the Montauk Boys program, because a lot of the Montauk boys that we ran into in Long Island remembered me. And I said, Preston says, well, how can they remember you? He said, you must have been part of that project. And finally, Preston remembered that I was. And I said, yes, I guess I was at one point. A lot of them remembered me. But at that point, I started to think about this. How many kids did they run through here? And based on what I knew at that time, in 1981, and some of the subsequent programs, my estimate at that time was, as proved to be later, very low. I estimated some 10,000 kids, maybe 20,000 kids have been run through the program up through 81. Maybe by 1981 it was around 10,000 to 20,000, but I think it was more now in view of what I know now. But as we examined this further, and I say further, I mean in the last 5 years, we realized that the programs were much larger than we had originally anticipated, and these Montauk kids were showing up all over. As I made trips around the country and around the world, I'd see these Montauk boys all over, and I might add, because of various things, I have a great deal of sensitivity, and I can see human auras, and it's very obvious a Montauk boy is a Montauk boy because it does damage to the aura, and it's permanent.
So would you say I'm a Montauk boy?
No.
Thank God.
There are some who are not, for various reasons. You have a rather different reason than most for not being one. You just weren't here in the U.S., and you were not apparently on the line for some reason to be part of the program when they started expanding all over the planet.
I take luck over skill there.
Anyway.
Anyway.
I did some research on this, and I involved some other people looking into it. Mm-hmm. And an individual who is now dead, but who at the time was very much alive, and I talked with him, and he did some lecturing on his own on some of the underground operations, though not the Montauk Boys thing, a man by the name of Phil Schneider. I mentioned this to him at one of the lectures when he showed up. This was about 93, 94. I mentioned the whole Montauk Boys program to him, and he became a little upset about it. He went to the local police department in Portland, Oregon, where he comes from, and said something about it, and he said they told him, you best keep your nose out of matters that don't concern you. So he got even more incensed and went to the FBI in Portland, and he fortunately latched on to one of the older people in the FBI who had been there over 22 years. And he says, Montauk Boys Program, yes, we know all about it. What are you doing about it? Nothing. Why not? Our hands are tied. What do you mean our hands are tied? He says, we can't do anything about it. But then he started discussing the, let's say, the numbers and the aspects of this. And he brought up to Phil some information which I was somewhat aware of, and I think many people are somewhat aware of, but not the full extent of it. Kids disappear in the U.S. all the time. This is well known. The FBI reports on it annually. And you see, of course, these pictures used to be on milk cartons. Now, in the supermarkets all over, have you seen this kid? Have you seen that kid? And they change the list periodically because they keep growing. Everybody's seen, at least been exposed to the fact that kids disappear around this country all the time. So the FBI came up with some very interesting statistics. And they told Phil, says, we have been in this program for quite some time, looking up and trying to find missing kids. It's our job. He says, do you have any idea how many kids disappear in the U.S. every year? Well, Phil didn't, and he told him. He says, 2 million, approximately, every year. Of that, he says, we recover or find information out as to what happened to about 1 million. He says, the other million, we never find anything out about. And so that's 2 million a year, and this has been going on for at least 20 years. So I looked at that, and based on Phil's data, I started doing some little number crunching in my head. I said, that smells to me like 20 million kids in 20 years who have vanished totally. Now, suppose half of them got pulled into the Montauk program. That's about 10 million Montauk boys programmed and ready and waiting to be used for something. That's a hell of a secret army. Hmm. Well, later on in 97, when the Air Force became involved in uncovering these Montauk tunnels, because see, this program was never military. This is the problem, which we had a great deal of problems trying to find out who's running the program. I always assumed it was a military or a government program. Mm-hmm. It was not.
Let's get into that, but for our listeners, I think it might be helpful to say that Phil Schneider is the son of Oscar Schneider.
That's correct.
And Oscar Schneider was the gentleman that you worked with on the Philadelphia experiment.
Yes, he was the chief medical officer.
Now, did Oscar also play a role at Montauk?
To my knowledge, no.
No.
He died in, I believe, about 92 or 93. I'm not sure the exact year.
So where did Phil get this interest in the Montauk Boys?
From me. He never heard of it before that. And he said to me when I brought the program up to him, mm-hmm. I said it's, to him, and his quote was, I said, it sounds to me like pedophilia. I says, well, in a certain sense, you could say that. And that's when he started looking into it, and that's when he ran into the FBI figures.
Okay.
And based on that, and also the fact that when the Air Force became involved in uncovering these secret bases on Long Island and elsewhere, and looking into the whole Montauk Boys program, at which point we finally realized that this was not a government program. The military had no part in it, except they were using some of the product, and the federal government was using some of the product.
So you never figured out who ran the show, did you?
No, but in 1997, we started to take another look at it. That is Preston, myself, and one or two other people. And Preston got into it very heavy, because he found, from the records, he was given access to the records for a period of time from that one location, under Sag Harbor, Long Island, which is where one of the processing bases were. The Air Force captured some of the personnel involved with it. There were low-level personnel wearing very strange gray uniforms with no name badges or rank insignia. It was not a military organization. It was a paramilitary organization. And they didn't know much. But the records they found, of course, they found dossiers in that one location of some 30,000 Montauk boys. Full dossiers with photos and everything.
Was this in 1997 they found
Yes,
this?
In 1997.
And Preston got this information?
He got the information. He was able to see the files because they wanted him to look through it for certain clues or certain other information.
Who is they?
The Air Force. And his superiors. And based on that, they started looking and finding other locations, and they started breaking into other locations. Before the year was out, the quote that came back to me via Preston was, "The Montauk Boys program is a very serious program." He says, "We will estimate that in the United States alone, there are at least 5 million program Montauk Boys." That was an Air Force official estimate. "And it is a worldwide problem," unquote.
Is it a problem or is it a secret army?
It's both. It's a problem in terms of what it does to some of the kids. It debilitates some. The older programs did. The newer ones are very, very effective, and they do not provide any debilitation anymore. But it debilitated some of them. Some of them rebelled. Some of them wanted help. Some of them committed suicide. And, of course, it was a problem in the sense that these kids are programmed to be used by somebody for something. Mm. Now, I will add that when I traveled around the world in my lecturing, not a lot of places, but I was in Switzerland, I've been in Germany, and I've been in Australia, the numbers of Montauk boys in Europe or in Australia are minimal. It is primarily a United States problem. It's a world problem in the sense that the programming techniques are over there and they are apparently being used to some extent. But in terms of percentage of young people who are used to become Montauk boys, today is saturation in the U.S. I would say it's about 90% of all the young people in the U.S.
Are these type of boys?
Yes. 90% of all of the young people, period. Not in Europe and not in Australia. It's an occasional one in Australia. I would put the percentage over there as maybe 1%, if that. And in Europe, not even 5%.
So 9 out of 10 boys. Are they boys and girls now?
It's now boys and girls. I'll have to get into that, how that expanded.
Okay.
But in the boys program was highly successful in terms of the electronic techniques.
Okay.
Now, there was electronic technique phase one, which is actually phase two in terms of the reference of how many systems have been used. But electronic system number one left its mark on the individuals in the sense that it showed in their auras or in body language. If you can read body language, you have to take special training courses for this. Preston did, and he was very good at reading the body language. He did it for his own reasons and his own purposes. But he could read, he said, within a second he could tell somebody's a Montauk boy, and I could tell it within a few seconds by looking at their aura. And we always agreed. So by two different techniques, we could say, yeah, he's a Montauk boy. He's been through the mill. Some of them are nervous. Some of them react badly. Some don't realize they are. And some of them, the more sensitive ones, are at a higher IQ, since in quite a few occasions this has happened around the country. They see me and they run the other way because they connect me with something they don't like subconsciously. They connect me with a Montauk program. And when at some subconscious level, they are aware of it. Consciously, they may not be aware of why, but they run the other way. But then as time went on, they went to electronic phase two, and that was prior to 97. This would occur, phase two electronics would be sometime around, I'll estimate, 92, 93. It was much smoother. It left less mark on the aura, and the individual was a little bit more normal acting. They didn't act like they were restricted, didn't act like they were being held back, or that they were simply not functioning as a normal young kid. Phase three went into effect in late 97. I was in Denver, Colorado when this happened. And that turned out a product that was so smooth that you could hardly detect the person, either by normal observation, by body language, or even by aura. In terms of looking and finding the aura mark, or shall we say the aura signature, you had to really look, know what to look for to find it. And in terms of their normal behavior, they were almost completely spontaneous. So this is one of the things the Montauk Boys program does. It wrecks the spontaneity of a young person. And in phase two, not as bad. Phase three is hardly any effect at all. But in phase three, which is now a totally different electronic approach, no pads at all, strictly RF, put the person or the group, because they could do group processing, if it was for the same type of programming, or the same program, I should say, they could process several at a time, up to about 30. You put them in this room, it has certain RF radiating elements in it, and what it does is it radiates a microwave signal with the proper modulations, accesses the human brain in the proper locations, puts them in the proper state, implants the program, tells them you won't remember this ever happened, puts in the access keys, and then, of course, it's over. And they can do that in about, I'll have to guess and hypothesize, 30 minutes. Maybe it's less.
Now, I want to be really clear on something. You're saying that 9 out of every 10 children in the United States have been physically taken to a location and gone through this process and then physically taken back?
Exactly, and correct, absolutely correct. That's in a staggering number, but that's what I see looking around anywhere. So Atlanta is one of the worst of all, but any major city in the U.S., now I'm not saying out in the boonies so much. You don't see as much of it out in the boonies, in the back country, but they pick them up mostly in the cities. And today you have to look hard to find a kid who has not been run through that program.
Well, I'm a parent, and I know a lot of other parents, and they don't let their kids out of their sight. How do they do it?
That's a very good question, and I'll tell you exactly how they do it. In the earlier aspects of the program, of course, they had to pick them up physically. When the Montauk Tunnel operation became successful, they would go all over the country or outside the country and pick up the candidates by means of the tunnel. Process them. It could take several days to a week. Then they take them back. However, when they take them back, they put them back in there, as is now refined, to within, let's say, 2 milliseconds of the time when they took them out, regardless of how long they were on the station. If they go back within 2 milliseconds, to the average human mind, there's no break there. You have to look very hard to find it, see it, or feel it. They don't realize anything's happened. The parents are not going to be aware of it. If they were taken out of their bed at night, or maybe while they're studying in the homework in the school, in their room at home, they're not going to be seen as having disappeared unless their parent just happens to be staring at them, and you can be caught and picking sure that the program managers are not going to pull a person out while the parents are staring and right there in the room and can possibly see what's happening. They pick them when they're alone. They pick them in a manner so that it's not obvious to the individual. They've made mistakes like picking people up when they're driving a car. In one case, Preston, a very serious accident resulted from that. He went to the hospital and had a facial reconstruction. Fortunately, he lived through it. And two cars were wrecked. But you have to time it very carefully. And in most cases now, if it's somebody that's important to the program, they'll only do it when they're either asleep at night or if they have to do it during the day and they're driving, they'll get a knock on the shoulder, a hand tap on the shoulder, which is a signal, pull over, park, then they do it. But this is for adults. Now, in the case of whether we need them for some program, in the case of the kids, they do it in a manner so they're not aware it's happened and the parents are not aware it's happened. And, of course, without attempts at erasing the memory of what they've been through, to merely be taken out and come back in, let's say, a 2 millisecond time period in their normal life time period or the normal lifespan as they normally see it.
It's nothing.
Then it's nothing. They're not going to be aware of it. Mm-hmm. You have to have a very high level of intelligence and be searching for something to find that something has happened.
But wouldn't you see a profound difference in the personality of the child?
In the older programs, you would.
But now you're saying
they won't see it.
You don't see any difference?
Not unless you look very carefully.
Okay, now, but
and you take said, a trained observer.
But you say that their spontaneity has gone away.
The spontaneity in the older programs went away, and in Phase 3 electronic, there's almost no loss of spontaneity.
Okay, so essentially the same person.
Essentially the same person, except they're programmed.
And the thing we really don't know is, what are they programmed to do?
Exactly.
And then how is that program activated?
When I was in the program, I asked that question. What are you going to use these kids for? I would never get an answer. They wouldn't give me any answers. I've since come to various conclusions about that, but at the time, there was no answer given. I said, when are you going to use these guys? What's your time target? And they said, 95 to 97. Now, of course, that's long since gone by. And some of them were used in that time period. Some have been used now through the various years, but there's been no mass usage of the product, so to speak, at least not to this point. So the question is raised and has arisen, what are they using for? I've seen a number of things where they have used them. There have been occasions like, let's see, back about 85. There was a series of fires sprung out in 8 cities across the United States the same night. Los Angeles and various other cities. Quite serious fires. There were arsonists and there were arson set. But the thing was, the police departments and the fire departments ordered hands off for a period of time. In L.A., I know this is the case. I assume that it was probably the case in the other cities. Now, how can you explain fires of a serious nature breaking out on the same evening in 8 cities scattered across the U.S. at approximately the same time? I say approximate, within an hour or two perhaps. And by morning, they've got them under control, but they all find arson, but nobody ever talks about it, and nobody says anything more again. How many other crimes have been incurred in the streets where the police can't solve them, or if they do have an idea what's happened, they won't talk? All police departments are on a gag order in terms of anything which smells like a Montauk boy operation. They may know. Police departments often know much more than they will tell the public. I mean, that's obvious to anyone who's followed this in the news and elsewhere, that police know things they don't talk about.
Well, let me say that the average person listening to this conversation is going to hope that you're wrong.
Well, I can agree with them. I would hope that I was wrong also. But unfortunately, I'm not.
You're pretty convinced. I mean, you are very convinced that this is real. Even though this is an alternative reality for you that you operated in.
I'm convinced it's real and it involves kids from this reality for the simple reason that in the period from about 1992 onward, Preston Nichols was engaged in deprogramming these kids on Long Island who had been through the Montauk program and the Montauk Mill. I was witness to a number of these deprogramming sessions, mm-hmm. and I didn't know that I was part of the program. He didn't either until about 85 and 86, and I became aware of it in 86. But from that point on, he became more involved in what did he do, and trying to recover the data, and then seeing the results, the Montauk boys all over the island, he became involved in trying to deprogram them. As this program of deprogramming continued onward, more and more became involved, and I would sit in on some of these sessions and see what he went through and what these kids were programmed, how they were programmed, the responses, and so forth. And when one sees in one town, as he invited me in late 96, Sag Harbor, Long Island, to come out, and he said, you want to see some Montauk boys? There's a town full of them there. It's a holding pen. There must be 125 of them here in this one town alone. And he says, many of them are aware of the fact that they are programmed. He says, some of them are, he said, the high IQ guys come out of it pretty quick, much faster than the average person. And they realize they've been programmed and they start looking for somebody to deprogram them. And he says, the word all over the island is, I'm doing the deprogramming. He says, they come to me. Meaning, of course,
Preston. How would he do it?
That, again, involves the reverse of the Wilhelm Reich techniques.
Was it a homosexual thing?
It's a sexual type thing. It's by consent. And he makes it quite clear that he's not trying to engage them in a homosexual action, activity. It's to deprogram them, and they almost all went along with it, and it did work because he had certain, guidelines he followed, and certain guidelines for deprogramming, which he knew based on the Wilhelm Reich material, and that a heightened level of Kundalini energy in the body will break the programming. And the only way you can heighten the Kundalini energy without doing it electronically is sexually. Because anybody who goes through a normal sex routine of normal sex, if they're aware of it, is there is a rise in the level of the Kundalini in the body. There's a heavy rise of energy at that point of orgasm that can be used to deprogram an individual, and that's what he was doing. And I got known throughout the island, too. But in any case, it was successful in enough cases that these kids would remember the rest of the program and the rest of what they've been involved in, and they started looking for him. Well, that time in Sag Harbor, I was amazed at how many kids were there. And, of course, I went to a New Year's party. And it was at that New Year's party I met a couple of them. And I also happened to meet, as a result of that, two of the Montauk boys. It turned out to be my own sons from the time, of course, of Edward Cameron.
Okay, this is new on me now. You said that you saw two of your...
I didn't know that they were my sons at the time that I saw them and met them. But
do you recall
they turned out that they were my sons, but I met them at that party, a New Year's party in
97, wow.
Yes, January.
Do you remember that event fairly well?
Well, quite well. I was at that party. It ran all night. They were all Montauk boys at that party, every one of them, except Preston. I suppose one could say except myself, because I was not a victim as such. I was a programmer or involved in the programming and changing the programming. And
that wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't. And I think there was one or two other people there who were not... Well, yes, there were two females there who were not Montauk boys. Mm-hmm. They weren't Montauk girls either. One of them was one of the guy's wives. Who had been in the program but has since gotten married. That was where I had my introduction to all of these guys are Montauk boys. The person said, yes, every one of them.
And you could tell, right?
Yes, I could tell.
By looking at them. Wow.
So that was an eye-opener for me. And, of course, from that point on, a lot more deprogramming was done. But then it started to get sticky because Preston was starting to deprogram some of those who were also in the military.
You know, could this be one of the reasons why there's such a backlash against homosexuality? If you're a homosexual, does that break the programming?
It could.
How about if you're
add something here, which I'm not sure whether this was a result of the early programming techniques or not. I don't have enough data to analyze it adequately. The early programmees, the early ones that survived the program, approximately 70% of them turned out to be homosexual. My understanding at the time was they were programmed to be that, but at the same time, it took a homosexual type of action to program them. Consequently, the thing which turned them homosexual. Huh. Now, with the electronic techniques, it didn't make any difference whether the individual had an inclination to be hetero, homo, bi, or whatever. The electronic program set in the program they wanted by inducing artificially the sexual state. Therefore, sexual activity as such was not involved. And I know the later programmers and such weren't concerned with this, and the later programs did not concern themselves with cranking out a high percentage of homosexuals. A certain percentage still were, but it was became quite low. There were operations where they wanted homosexuals, so they had about a 10% thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they could change the sexuality of an individual. Mm-hmm. Either way.
Okay. Fascinating. Now I'm going to get back to Montauk. And in 1983, that's when Ed Cameron, you as Ed Cameron, arrived on the base.
That's correct.
And many other interesting events happened August 12, 1983.
Yes.
This ties much together. Could you sort of go through all the things that happened on that one day?
An awful lot happened on that day.
Indeed.
Number one, I as Ed Cameron and Duncan as his original self and his original body arrived from the Philadelphia experiment. And about 2 a.m. in the morning of 12 August 1983, prior to the arrival of us, about 3 days prior, I, as Al Bielek, was told, take a vacation, get off the base. Duncan was transferred to another operation on the base at the time of arrival, or shall we say before the time of arrival, maybe 12 hours before, when, I don't know exactly because I wasn't there. But he was removed from his normal location on the base. We arrived as those in the Philadelphia experiment. We left approximately 12 hours later, about 2 p.m. in the afternoon. And it was after that point when Duncan was given the instructions, being in the chair, a set of code words. I will use a hypothetical set of code words. The time is now. I don't know if that's what it was said to him or not. Mm-hmm. But assuming that was it, that was to set into operation the program for destruction of the Montauk base. Now, it had already been decided about 6 weeks prior to that. As a group got together, the group included Duncan, Preston, myself, and a number of other people to discuss what are we going to do about this operation called Montauk. It's evil. It's done a lot of bad things. It's going to continue unless we do something about it. And there was a number of meetings, series of meetings, off base, of course, over lunch or whatever. And a number of people, some scientists, Duncan and Preston became the core of it, decided that the station had to go. And they had to set up a technique to do it.
Now, but 1981, the whole Montauk Boys program pulled out of there.
That's
and
true.
And to me, that was what was evil.
That's true, but they still had other things ongoing. There were other projects apparently ongoing, which still gave them the idea that it was an evil station and had to be stopped. Dr. von Neumann, who was still there as a consultant, got wind of this, and he was absolutely horrified. He said, they can't shut this down. He says, we need this station for other research, which is coming up in the future. There are other problems we need it for. And we said, yeah, there were some serious problems. They've all been corrected. But he said, we need the station. Well, he was only a consultant. He had no authority to do anything. Mm-hmm. Maybe he did try.
Did Jack Pruitt know about this plan?
I don't know whether Jack Pruitt knew about it or not. I think they worked very hard to keep it from him. But they finally made the decision, as they knew from the records which were available, that on the 12th of August, as two guys from the Philadelphia experiment were arriving, and of course von Neumann knew it, and he was there to greet us. And after we returned back, sent back to the Eldridge, then it was clear. Preston sat Duncan down in the chair sometime in the afternoon, gave him the command, and of course out of Duncan's subconscious was created this monster, looked like a Sasquatch from the pictures we have of it, but can't be sure it's a Sasquatch, it just resembles it somewhat. Literally came out of Duncan's subconscious, the station having long since been proven that it could do this, clothed the thing in a physical reality of our three-dimensional reality, and this creature went stomping around the station, destroying buildings and whatever, and picking people up when it got in its way, and throwing them aside someplace and killing a few. The word got around rather quickly that a monster was loose on the base. We got to stop it. It didn't come up on base operation until late afternoon, from what I was told later. But it was making considerable progress in destroying buildings on the base, and then it headed for the radar tower because, however it was programmed or instructed, it knew that was where the heart of things were, at least on the surface. And it went in the tower, and apparently, I think it went in the tower. I wasn't there to know whether it did or not. It was told the various conflicting stories. It went in the tower, it went around the tower, it was seen in the vicinity of the tower. But at that time, Pruitt went to Preston, and he says, you've got to do something about this. But before he got to the point of accosting Preston to do it, the orders went out, kill the power in the tower, kill the power on the project. Well, they went for the main power control switches that fed power from Lilco into the tower building, the radar tower, and on the surface of the other interconnecting links of computers and such. And all of the switches were frozen like on the Eldridge. So the word went out, go find the main power feeds and cut them, hack them with axes, what do you have to do? So they found the set of feeds coming in, cut them, nothing happened. They said, there's got to be a secondary set of feeds, and there were. They found them, and they cut those. The lights went out, and that's all that happened. The lights in the buildings went out. The lights in the tower went out.
The computer kept running.
And the computer system kept running. How can this be? There's no power feeding it. The damn thing's still running. And Junior's still running around, as we called him.
But you called this Sasquatch Junior, huh?
Yeah, that was our nickname for him.
Okay.
We do come up with strange names under pressure. So Pruitt went to Preston and says, you're going to go in that radar tower and you're going to start cutting things up. He says, I'm not going in there. And out came a 45. He says, oh, yes, you are. And here's a portable acetylene tank. You put it on your back, the back carrier, and you got the torch. And get in there.
Now, so was the computer inside the radar tower?
Part of the computer system was in the radar tower, a very critical one. It was an all-electronic old tube type built by AIL, and I've seen it, and it's got the name tags and everything on it.
And it was important to destroy this computer because that's what maintained the...
Had to destroy that computer, had to destroy the modulating system for the two huge amplitron, not so huge, but high-powered amplitron tubes in the tower, which were drivers for the 24 of them down in the basement, as we called it, which ran the main system.
But it was a computer that maintained the physical... Sasquatch, right?
Yes, the whole system did, because not only the memory system, but the main computer driving all of the very exotic electronic systems, it kept the thing going. And what you had to do was literally hack up the brain. So what they were doing was go in there and cut up the brain, cut up the feeds to the two driver tubes up in the tower, and everything else handy that you could cut. So Preston went in there and started hacking away at them with the acetylene torch. You couldn't cut these electronic feeds by hand, you might electrocute yourself with the acetylene torch with a high-powered gas flame and protective clothing. You can get away with it. So he did, and after he cut enough of the links, and there's still torch marks on the building and the interior which show, the system stopped functioning. And when the system stopped functioning, then, of course, Junior vanished. At least we thought he had. And he disappeared from sight. Everything calmed down, quieted down at that point. And it was essentially over.
Al, do you think everything's just an illusion?
Do I what? Mind repeating that?
Well, if Junior can appear and disappear, and by the way, for you listeners, we do have pictures of Junior.
Yes.
Because when it was shut down, apparently he was frozen in a certain dimension, which when you take a picture of that dimension... from the top of the tower, you can see him.
And frozen in time also, because he wasn't moving.
And so we have a couple of those pictures on the CD, and you'll see how to get there. But, you know, it just brings to mind, isn't everything just an illusion?
Well, there are those in the Orient, and the so-called adepts, who say that this life is an illusion and everything is an illusion. From another perspective, outside of our physical reality, you might well be able to say that.
There must be something that's calling you and me here, calling this desk here, calling this computer here.
Why is all of this a reality? My best answer to this, after Montauk and after looking at all of this, it's a training school. It's a school. It's a prison planet, and it's a training school at the same time. And everyone is here for a reason. They're stuck here. They were put here. They came here of their own free will, perhaps. But you got stuck here. Once you start partaking of the physical reality of this planet and become part of the society and the civilization, you're part of it, and you're stuck for quite a while. That is my answer to it. If you get out of the system, out of the reality of this planet and out of the reality of our physical system, you're somewhere else, and it may all be in a totally different viewpoint. All of this may be an illusion. to us, it is definitely not an illusion.
No, I mean, it doesn't seem like that. Hey, Al, have you ever seen
when a car can crash into somebody and kill them, when a car can crash into a building and wreck the building and the car, that's hardly an illusion, at least from our point of reference.
Right, right. Did you ever see the movie The Matrix?
I'm sorry?
The Matrix. Did you ever see that
movie? I did indeed. That's the other side of the coin.
Well, certainly this is making me think about that movie.
Where everything is an illusion created and maintained by a computer.
Exactly.
And you can get outside of the computer and you can get into the illusion, or you can become a thinking part of the illusion capable of independent action. Mm-hmm. So there are those people on this planet who become independent, so to speak, of the illusion and can become, should I use the word controller? What should I use? They can become independent of the illusion to a great degree. Now, maybe that's where some of our world-beating world controllers come from. Maybe they're outside of the illusion and looking at it and decided they want to play their own game. Now, I am hypothesizing at this point, of course.
What about like Jesus Christ?
I would say that he was not only part of the illusion, he was also outside of it, because he saw it really for what it was, and he was trying to, in his own way, in his own time, wake people up that there was something else going on than just what they saw. I mean, that's the message of religion, basically. There's something else going on in the universe than what you see in front of your eyes and ears.
Indeed. Okay, so we've gotten to 1983. What happened after this monster finally got frozen?
When this little operation was over and the computer was shut down, we had a little time to think about it. The first thing, of course, that happened was Junior was frozen in a location on the base where it can still probably see him today, but at least we did years later when we went back to take some pictures. But we started to think about this. What was sustaining Junior? What happened? How was a computer able to keep functioning when we cut off all the power feeds to it? Well, years ago, quite a few years ago, Einstein made a statement which came back to mind then. If you develop a machine with sufficient complexity and feed it with enough power, it will in time become intelligent of itself. And this said that with this system that we had there, which had plugged into it all of the scientific data of our creation, all of the scientific data that we know, all of the celestial data for astronomy, you name it, in terms of the technical knowledge, the total mass technical knowledge of our society and civilization was all plugged into the computers there, because they didn't know what place they might want to go to next or what thing they might want to do next. And a machine of the size that it was, and the amount of power which it consumed, which was up around 500 megawatts, it had enough power and enough intelligence, artificial intelligence, if you will, to become intelligent. And therefore, it solved the problem of how to feed itself power without Lilco's help. And since we cut off Lilco, it kept its own power feeds from whatever source going and kept running until we cut up the brain, so to speak, and shut off the ability for it to compute, to feed itself power, to do anything anymore. So that was the end of the Montauk operation as we knew it. It was the end of the surface operations. And what happened after that was interesting, because not only was Junior frozen in a particular location, but what people survived this, many fled off the base, some stayed on the base. And there was one engineer who came to Preston about a year or two later. I think it was more than about 3 years later, said that for a couple of weeks he stayed on the base, and he watched the fact that in about 1 week after they shut down on the night of 12 August, a couple of platoons of Marines came in with orders to kill anything that moved, and they were shooting all over the base. And the orders were to kill anything that moved, human or not. And he says a few more died. They were still hiding out there, quite terrified and afraid to do anything except stay on the base.
Did these Marines go to the underground facilities?
No, this was on the surface only. And the next thing that happened, he said, a few days after that, some cement trucks start to arrive, fully loaded with cement, about 26 of them in succession. It plugged up every staircase, every known entrance to the underground, which existed on the surface. Sealed them all off, even put a plug in the elevator shaft and the radar tower, so that no one could, from the surface, without knowing special access, because a few were left open, find their way into the underground. So that was the end of surface operations.
Were there people in the underground who got trapped when that happened?
Don't really know. I had no contact with the underground or any of the operations until I ran into somebody in recent years who was there at that time. And they continue to function. There were obviously means of getting in. Excuse me. There were means of getting in and out because operations did not cease underground. They continued for another year and a half.
Well, what happened with you? Because you were just away from the base for a little while.
When I came back, I was grabbed and debriefed. Debriefing, of course, means in the military parlance that what do you remember about what happened? What tell us in detail? All that you remember about what you have been through and so forth. And when it was over, they gave us the brainwashing, which wiped the memories of Montauk. Now, and of course, that totally eliminated for a period of time, not very long, any possibility of recalling my involvement in Montauk or that I was working at Montauk simultaneously to the fact that I was an engineer, consulting engineer, running all over the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's another aspect of this whole thing which gets into some very difficult areas of parallel realities and how can you be in two different places at the same time or what appears to be the same time. So I was no longer functioning with Montauk, and Montauk was shut down on the surface until 1987. It was 4 years. They did some rebuilding, not on the surface, but underground. And the underground operations persisted until sometime in 1985. That I have from a friend of mine who shut everything down at that time and then exited. With that, they did go into the underground of Montauk and do an extensive rebuilding, added two more levels underground, apparently, from what I hear, and resumed operations with the old management core, if you will, sometime in 87. Now, that, again, gets into an area where my memories were wiped, let's say, the post-Montauk operations, except there was actually still Montauk. But we were doing some very special projects, not the usual things. The Montauk Boys program and everything related to it was gone off of Montauk, was continuing on elsewhere. All of the research programs of Montauk that we knew at that time were dead, with the exception of one that was revived. And that was the part two of the one that occurred in early 1983 of this planet or planets on the opposite side of the galaxy recovering these cylindrical objects. Part two took place in 1987 to recover the object of light energy, as I call it. And that was successful. And we were off of that and then back. I was involved on the periphery of some projects after that. Precisely what at Montauk, I don't know. But I do know that I had to keep tabs on another project upstate New York before the resumption of Montauk, which involved a friend of mine who turned up much later. And that was a totally different operation involving nothing whatever of Montauk, but another one of the many secret projects that the government was involved in.
So, Al, did your involvement with Montauk sort of end in 1988?
It ended in 1988.
You began remembering the Philadelphia experiment,
yes.
Right?
When I remember the Philadelphia experiment, that was cut off from all further government projects of that nature, Montauk or any of the others. And, of course, in time, as I remember the Philadelphia experiment and sought and acquired some, shall we say, psychological help to understand some of the things that were going on. This one person found out that I had some severely unbalanced energy levels in my brain, which was indicative of imbalance between the right and left brain lobes, so he didn't put it that way, and other problems, which he helped me with. And 6 months later, he said, when you get over this and you rebalance, says you will have a rather heavy return of memory. And he was quite correct. And about 6 months after that, all kinds of lost memories came back relative to Montauk, relative to the Philadelphia experiment, relative to other things which I have been involved in, including the beginnings of recovery of the fact that there is much more to the Philadelphia experiment than I had realized.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are actual operations today going on at Montauk in the underground facilities?
Very definitely so. The original group, Management Corps, resumed operations on a sporadic basis in 1988, and they kept going at it, doing what I don't know, or I should say 87, and went on through until sometime in 1991. Now, this was a civilian management group. It was not military. They had government oversight and, of course, intelligence community oversight. In 1991, the Air Force took over the entire operation, underground and surface, but, of course, nothing was ongoing on the surface. That was a perfect cover. The buildings were abandoned. Everything was abandoned. And it just was maintained in that position of total neglect. We don't care what's here, it's all abandoned appearance. Yes, it was abandoned on the surface, but there were other underground operations ongoing, and there were guards running around on the surface, which we found out about. But in 1991, the Air Force took over for a very special operation. They took over everything, and that operation, as Preston called it later, and it was an official title, was Operation Sky Pebbles. This became an ongoing military operation until sometime in, I believe, June of 1998, when the Air Force pulled out, locked up the base, and at that point, the Navy wasn't happy about it. They wanted to get in there and run the show for whatever they wanted, and they forcibly broke their way in sometime in, I believe, July or August of 1998. And they are now running the show and have been ever since that time period to this day. What the Navy's doing in there, we don't know. We do know what the Air Force was doing, and that was very extensive research on particle beam weapon systems and developing a system which would be able to shoot down at long range UFOs or what have you outside the atmosphere of the Earth. And it's been also useful in repelling other objects, and the primary purpose for the Air Force in Operation Sky Pebbles was to deflect and prevent the Hale-Bopp comet from plowing into the Earth. Because, as was found out by NASA and Air Force operating together for a period of 10 years prior to the actual arrival of Hale-Bopp at its closest point in approach to the Earth, they knew about it 10 years prior, actually in 1988. And they knew it was a very large comet, the largest in recorded, and it was being followed by an object which apparently was controlling it. The classified information, which I got through various channels, said that there were 23 course corrections to make sure that Hale-Bopp would crash into the Earth. And the intent was to wipe out one half of the Earth's population in one shot by creating enormous tidal waves, either from the ocean or Earth. Earth tidal waves, of course, in a major collision.
Seems like if that really actually happened, that would have taken care of everybody, not one half.
It might well have taken care of nearly everybody, yeah, except those who were already outside waiting for the event and who came back later and planned to come back later to manage, that is, totally control in the New World Order, those survivors. It didn't happen that way, and it didn't happen because the Air Force acted on their own and very responsibly and very successfully. They diverted it. Preston was a major part of that operation. He's told me a lot of things which perhaps should not be part of this record. But they did deflect it very successfully, and by doing that, certain aspects of human history have changed. We, at this point, are writing our own history. Because it had been recorded hundreds of years before that a comet where a large heavenly body would crash into the Earth in 1998, and not only was some of the prize prognosticators from the past involved in saying this, that this would happen, but certain people in the present time are saying it, and the NASA's own predictions in terms of computer predictions of an ongoing object and the trajectory which it would follow.
You're talking about like Nostradamus, his predictions?
Nostradamus and all of the rest.
Did Edgar Cayce
Edgar Cayce was in on it to some extent. I do not know what he specifically said about Hale-Bopp, if anything. But a number of other people all indicated there's going to be a major upheaval in 1998, and it did not happen. Mm-hmm. Other possibilities exist for the future of asteroids hitting us. That's known, but at this point, there were only predictions of possibilities.
So what did we do? Did we actually shoot that thing?
What we did was we provided for its safe removal from from a crash trajectory to one that curved around the Earth, actually a little bit earlier than the original projection. The very early one said it would pass around the Earth. But every trajectory correction that came in after that point showed it coming in either in a very close or a direct collision. Eventually it said direct collision. We moved it around so it left safely, along with its huge atmosphere, which was methane chlorine, which would not have been helpful to life on Earth at all. And when it was sufficiently passed, they hit it again and broke it up into six pieces. That part is in the public domain about it breaking into six pieces. The rest of it is not. And the object following it was eventually destroyed.
How is it that the Navy actually ousted the Air Force?
They didn't. The Air Force left of their own volition and locked up the base and just left everything. And about 2 months later, the Navy came in. They crashed their way in through the gates because in about 93, they established a whole new periphery of gates, controls, key card access entries, guard gates, access for trucks through guarded entries, and a lot of activity, including people living on a special housing project adjacent to the base who worked on the base underground and were, shall we say, very carefully shielded and guarded.
But there was a period of time when just about anybody could have walked out to
that
base.
That is true.
And during that period of time, were there still underground operations?
Under part of it, yes. In other words, from 1983 on, you could walk all over the base until approximately 1991, 92. Actually, we went in February 93, and you could see they were in the process of reconstruction, but they didn't have roving guards yet. Underground was still functional until mid-85, and there were people obviously working in the underground, but how they gained access at that point, I don't know. On the surface, it all appeared dead. Another way for monitoring the fact that it was coming back online was the fact that Preston, of course, had his own bus full of electronic monitoring gear, and from 87 on, there was electronic signals coming back out of the point, as he called it, meaning the Montauk area, which had been shut down for a period of almost 4 years. And he was monitoring these. They came back online, and they were on periodically. And after 91, they were on a rather a full-time basis.
You know, if you would go out to Montauk, to the town that's close by, I guess the name of the town is Montauk?
That's correct.
And talked with some of the people who live there, would they say strange things are happening over there, or would they say, oh, it's just an old dead Air Force base?
In the period from, let's say, early 70s, more particularly from 75, 76 onward through 83, they would have told you there were strange things happening, particularly when all of the birds flew west in the summer. And all of the animals are out on the point, ran right through the town of Montauk. And in the period when they had the tunnel and all of that equipment working the way they wanted it, there were some of the most violent weather changes in a half-hour period that anybody would ever hope to experience and probably would never want to experience again. Well, they said in the town and that whole northern strip, in a whole area of the island out there, in the middle of the summer, it could be 85 degrees, and half an hour later it was snowing. The weather dropped that fast in temperature when they went online on the station. Animals fled. They couldn't stand the vibes. People moved out of the area also. They couldn't stand it. They were too close to the operating base. And since then, of course, the animals have wandered back. But people just picked up and left their homes because they couldn't take what was going on there, between the very erratic weather, all kinds of strange reactions to the animals, and human reactions also. Yes, there were strange things going on, and the people said so at that time. After 83, no.
Why after 83, no?
Well, the base was shut down on the surface, and the underground operations didn't affect them. And what they have been doing out there since then with Operation Sky Pebbles and whatever the Navy is doing now does not seem to affect the town or any of the people living there. What the Navy's doing, we don't know. We assume they're following on with particle beam weapon research, but that is purely an assumption. Mm-hmm. And Preston has no feedback from the Navy. He's in the Air Force, and the Navy's not telling the Air Force what they're doing, officially or unofficially. Now, maybe at the Joint Chiefs level they know, but certainly not at, let us say, the more common level.
Now, you said that they're actually trying to erase the fact that there ever was an Air Force base there.
Currently, they are razing all the buildings, for the exception of the radar tower. The power station is long since gone, and I believe one other administrative building they're leaving operational on the surface. The rest of the buildings, I said, are so decrepit because of their age that they're tearing them down. It's not the Army Corps of Engineers. There's another government group in there now that's officially doing it, and this is ongoing at the present time.
This is the Park Service?
No, it's not the Park Service. It's another group of the government. Hmm.
Okay, so the saga continues with the Montauk story. Al, thanks for spending this time with us.